Well, hello everybody, welcome back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. This is the final part in a series of episodes of exploring demon possession movies. And if you want to check out some reviews of those, then just visit theflicksthechurchforgot.com and you can listen to those previous entries. But for now, we're going to step away from the movie portrayals of the possession phenomenon, and now we're going to explore the real-life idea of demonic possession and exorcism, asking if this really is a thing that happens, or if perhaps instead it's all in the mind. Concepts of gods and deities have been around as long as people have, and so too is the idea of malevolent spirits, entities that are there not to bless or prosper, but to steal, kill, and destroy. And despite the tendency of Hollywood horror to present the demonic through a largely Catholic framework, the idea of demons feature in many different cultures and belief systems. However, it is true that it's the Christian demons, as it were, that have played the biggest part in informing the horror genre, at least in the West, and so that's what we'll inevitably focus on. In a nutshell, the claim of Christianity is that God created angels and gave them the gift of free will, and they could choose to obey him or not. And the ones who rejected God became known as demons, with their leader being Satan. And the idea is that they were, and indeed still are, permitted to tempt human beings into sin. Yet now and again, the claim is that demons get even bolder than that, not just tempting people into bad behaviors, but going one step further and actually entering the body of those people, possessing them so that the demons themselves could order the body around to do blasphemous and God-mocking behavior. Exorcism, therefore, comes in as a ritual or a rite that, if you will, issues the squatter demons their eviction orders. The idea of exorcism has some common features, and these are often reflected in horror movies. For a start, they are usually performed by some religious expert. So this is a specialized skill that's not for anybody, and you often see this in horror movies where, you know, they have to go to get outside help and they have to consult the church. It's really unusual, I guess, to have seen the film, the 2012 film that I reviewed earlier, The Possession, where the father actually attempts to do an exorcism himself, and quite right, I can understand why he would, to try and save his daughter, but his lack of qualifications somehow means that he stirs the evil up rather than casts it out. There's also some common aspects to the ritual that we see reflected in horror, which includes an insistence on the religious professional trying to figure out the name or the identity of the demon involved, and that's something that often crops up in films. There's this sense of like, what's your name? You know, tell me who you are, identify yourself. And because the demon doesn't want to be antagonized or cast out, a spiritual conflict occurs with religious representative on one side and the demon on the other, but the battleground is the writhing, screaming body of the possessed person themselves. Now, in Christianity, it's always a demon who's possessing the victim, and it's not a ghost of a dead person. However, that's not always the case in some of the faiths and cultures. Remember the Jewish concept of the dibbuk, which I discussed when I reviewed The Possession, where a restless spirit might inhabit the body, or when I was in Romania in Transylvania recently and learned about the concept of the strigoi, where the spirit of a dead person returns to their body to repossess it and cause havoc. Hindus have something similar, where a person who dies before their time, as it were, are at risk of returning to possess a living person. Yet again, possession in horror tends to always veer towards the Christian flavor, and therefore it's demons we tend to see up there on the screen. And we see demonic possession in the Bible, it crops up throughout the ages, yet increasing secularization tends to render demonic explanations for human behavior at best inappropriate, or at worst a flat-out misreading of the situation. And indeed, this is a very welcome caution for people to have. A number of high-profile possession cases, such as the famous one of Annelise Michel from 1976, the German student who died as a result of the injury sustained during an exorcism, to the more recent cases in the UK, like the horrifying story of Victoria Klimbeye, an 8-year-old girl from the Ivory Coast who suffered a horrific exorcism at the hands of her parents, and that involved being burned by cigarettes, being hit with hammers and bike chains and wires, and being tied up for 24 hours or more. Look, you don't have to have young children to be thoroughly disgusted by cases like that, but for me, being a father myself, the thought of that girl suffering in that way is just horrific. And I think it's one of the reasons why I am so cautious and even reluctant to look for a demonic explanation in the behaviors of others. If the devil really is at work, then it wasn't in the body of Victoria, but rather he was loose in the forces around her that not only caused the abuse, but blinding those authorities who didn't act on it when it was found to be happening. So anyway, it's into this sort of tense and controversial environment where ancient religious ritual meets modern-day skepticism and scandal that we address the topic of demonic possession. And to help us get our heads around this, I'd like to share with you some things that I learned at a recent conference I attended at Goldsmiths College in London. It was organized by the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomenon, and the day was called Seriously Possessed. Now, I like ASAP in that they don't have a central belief agenda, they simply represent a methodical exploration of the paranormal, and they don't tie themselves to either a skeptical or a believer identity. And this neutrality on the subject was really reflected in the speakers they had lined up for the day, who varied from skeptical psychologists to full-on believer spirit mediums who were talking about ectoplasm shooting out of people and stuff, so it was quite a variety. So let me just share a little about what the speakers said, and then I can offer some of my own reflections too. The first speaker of the day was Professor Chris French. Now, I was familiar with him, having seen him crop up on various UK TV shows and news programs. He's a professor of psychology at Goldsmiths, and he's also the coordinator of something called the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit, whose aim is to explain paranormal events in terms of physical and psychological factors. So it's not a surprise then to find that Professor French has a skeptical view when it comes to possession. He presented a fascinating list of psychological and neurological conditions that could help give rational medical explanations of a supposed possessed person's behavior. For example, epilepsy and Tourette's syndrome can appear very similar to so-called possession. And he also mentioned alien hand syndrome, which is a rare neurological condition that causes hand movement to take on a life of its own. Think Evil Dead 2, only a lot more depressing because it's real. As well as giving the psychological explanations for demonic possession, he also made a few interesting points that I, frankly, hadn't considered before. For example, he said that charismatic churches and Christians actively seek to be possessed when they desire to speak in tongues. And I must admit, I remember when I was first looking into Christianity and I attended a Pentecostal church for a while, which they were a really nice bunch of people and I enjoyed going there. But, you know, I did go to a meeting once in a small little room where everybody was speaking in tongues, and the pastor was encouraging me to let the Spirit of God climb into me, as it were, and to start taking control of my mouth. Now, despite the fact that pretty much everyone around me was doing it, I didn't do it myself, and I still found it all a fascinating experience. But looking back on it now, I can definitely see what French means by people seeking to be possessed by God's Spirit. In other words, he was pointing out an angle of possession which I hadn't thought about before, that while we often assume possession as being demonic, it can also be viewed as in positive terms for the recipient or the observer. Indeed, later that day we heard from a spirit medium and exorcist called Susan Laybourne, who shared some of her first-hand accounts of possession, and she spoke about her experiences with African shamans, where people intentionally seek to be taken over by a spirit. She described it as blending, which is a much cozier term than possession. Anyway, getting back to French, he talked about how demonic possession and the exorcism ritual can also be explained in terms of it being a sociocognitive experience. Social cognitive theory says that we learn how to think and behave by simply observing the actions and patterns of others. We look at society and through the media. And so, for example, films like The Exorcist and all its imitators have literally taught us as a culture what it looks like to be possessed. I.e. possessed person screams and hides from the cross or uses sexually aggressive language or writhes on a bed, etc. And French and others are saying that this could help explain the instances we get of demonically possessed people supposedly responding to an exorcism. In other words, it's all just theater, where the possessed person or even the observers, even the priest, are acting out their parts in such a way that they convince themselves that what is happening is a reality. French shared an example of female Malaysian factory workers who were regularly acting possessed so that they could have an excuse to act a little wilder than they normally would. I find this all quite intriguing, the idea of the desirability of being possessed, because for some, being possessed, or rather seen to be possessed, has secondary benefits, not least because the possessed person becomes the subject of a great deal of attention. As human beings, we crave significance, and we can act like a maniac for a while, knowing that at some point we can switch back into human personality. We get our attention and notoriety, but at the other end, we are a cleansed human being. And I think, you know, psychology can be so deep that I'm not suggesting that some of these people who think they're possessed are just flat out lying, although some might be, but some might have been so conditioned into believing this that they literally think this is true, and they are sort of fulfilling a self-fulfilling prophecy, when in actual fact it's this kidding with one another in the theater, the theatrics of possession. I think that's a pretty interesting theory, and I'm convinced that that will probably be the case for some examples of supposed demonic possession. There was another skeptical psychologist speaking who I found really intriguing. He's called Dr. Kieran O'Keefe, and he's done quite a lot of academic research into the validity of paranormal claims. What I liked about him was that he clearly has what author Lynn Thatcher would call the spooky gene. In other words, he may have a skeptical outlook, but there seems to be a genuine fascination with the supernatural. For example, at the start of the talk, he showed the hall a copy of his 1678 exorcism manual. Now, I'm not really sure which edition he had or anything, but what I do remember him saying is that as a teenager, he saved up his pocket money to buy this. So I thought that was pretty cool and quite an interesting insight into his character. But he gave a really helpful talk, stressing that church ministers involved in this area are not as backward or cavalier as some people accuse them to be. He talked about how the exorcists he knew were very cautious and would take a multidisciplinarian approach to each case. Doctors and psychologists would be involved in the process of potential exorcism rather than a rush to the religious option. He even said perhaps priests and exorcists are in a better position to diagnose what might be going on with an afflicted person in this way because they have so much experience in this specific area. He did also offer an angle I'd not heard of before. He said that while there are indeed psychological and neurological explanations for possession, such as epilepsy or Tourette's, like we've heard earlier, there was also an area that I hadn't considered. He talked about an acute form of encephalitis, which, if you're not sure, is an acute inflammation of the brain. The form he talked about was, brace yourself for my terrible pronunciation, antimethyl diaspartate receptor antibody encephalitis, which is also known as ANMDA. Now, in a book called Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness, a lady called Susanna Cahalan said that she describes that she went through having this condition and how similar it appears, according to O'Keefe, to possession. The book, incidentally, is going to be made into a film with Dakota Fanning starring and Charlize Theron producing. So, there was a lot of interesting angles from Dr. O'Keefe, and it actually turns out that he was offering an online course through the School of Parapsychology and Possessions and Exorcism, which I think looks quite interesting, and if I wasn't so busy with other stuff, I'd be tempted to pay the 50 quid and do it, but I just got too much on, so I'm not going to be able to do that. Another speaker who I found particularly interesting was Dr. Amanda van Eck de Meijer van Twist, who's a sociologist and is a deputy director of a really interesting group called INFORM. Now, INFORM stands for the Information Network on Religious Movements, and they're an independent charity that provide up-to-date information on new religious movements, cults and sects, and what they call non-conventional religions. She shared how the majority of exorcisms were found to be happening among Christian groups, particularly the Charismatic and Pentecostal Church. And certainly we do see reports in Britain of children being exorcised because they're thought to be possessed or to be involved in witchcraft. But Van Twist makes a good cautionary note by saying the media debate about this subject is often too focused on African churches, when Twist says the problem is far more widespread than that. There were a couple of sessions today that also took me by surprise. First up was an occultist called Duncan Barford, who shared a lot about the Goetia, or the Lesser Key of Solomon, which is a demonology book well-loved by the infamous occultist Aleister Crowley. But what stood out for me was his approach to the demonic world. He would happily try to summon demons and ask them to affect his life. But what was surprising was that he admitted that for him, he wasn't channeling actual real-life demons at all. But these instead were imaginative tricks to unlock the spiritual part of his psyche. In effect, he was saying that occultism and demons summoning was a work of the imagination and a sort of psychological theater. At one point, he talked about how, statistically speaking, religious people tend to be happier. And so even though he didn't think it's rational to actually believe in deities, he said, perhaps it's rational to be irrational for the sake of increased happiness. This rather unusual point, but intriguing point, was shared also by a group of people who were discussed in another lecture called The Demons of Modernity, Possession and the Cthulhu Mythos in Contemporary Culture, where anthropologist and H.P. Lovecraft fan Justin Woodman talked about a UK group called the Haunters of the Dark. Now, Woodman joined the group and participated in their rituals where they used a purely fictional monster gods of H.P. Lovecraft's fiction and used them as what he would call phenomenological masks, or in other words, to use fictitious Cthulhu and others as a way of looking at the universe and unlocking the spirituality within. Again, like Barford, these people were seeking demonic influence or possession, but from purely fictional entities. It's almost like an extreme religious version of role-playing, a sort of psychological cosplay. Now, for some people, they would say that's what all religious people do. You know, that Christians are just sort of kidding themselves in thinking there's a God up there because it helps them. And these guys are just saying, we know we're just kidding ourselves, but it still helps us. And there was a sort of refreshing honesty in that, of people admitting that what they believe is false, but that they believe it anyway because it makes them feel better. It's like the classic postmodern approach, you know, truth is what you make it. So that was interesting. However, I must admit that while I can really sympathize with the power of the imagination to unlock parts of the soul and the psyche, I still feel like, for me, I want to base my life on something I believe actually exists in reality. And so for me, I don't think I could last long throwing my faith into something I knew wasn't true. You know, I might sometimes have a doubt about the existence of God from time to time, but ultimately I believe in him because I actually think he does exist. I feel like sort of beyond me, there is a fundamental fact that I'm putting my trust in, or putting my faith in. I may be wrong, I may be right, but I'm not sure I've got the personality who could handle still trusting in something that I knew full well was fallacious. The last session of the day was great. It was from a historian called John Canico James, and what I loved about his session was that after all the wild day's journey into unexpected facets of the subject of possession, he wound it back to the case that inspired The Exorcist, and he tried to present the facts behind that case, which is apparently not an easy task given the patchy information available and the sometimes changing data on it. He also threw in plenty of examples of historical possession cases, including the fascinating notion that Christians sometimes made the possessed person preach as they had special knowledge of the things of God, being devils and all. I found that really interesting. I've never heard that before. And so at the end of the day, I was left with a much wider appreciation of what the term demonic possession might cover. But also I noticed that as I chatted to various people over wine in the student bar afterwards, many people kept asking me the same question. Do I think demonic possession is a reality or not? You know what? My answer is, well, I am really actually quite skeptical about demonic possession, in the sense that I think many, if not most, cases could be explained by neurological or psychological factors, especially when there seems to be no hard evidence available of unexplainable things happening, like no unequivocal footage of eyes whiting over or people levitating. That is the sort of stuff that would be hard to explain away and would help be proof of possession, but we never really see it. But a person swearing or screaming or having an aversion to holy symbols may look demonic because it's part of our sociocognitive expectation of a possession, but it doesn't prove that they are. Anyone can pretend or trick themselves into being averse to holy symbols. You know, this could just be all acting in the theater of possession or other reasons. However, I'm saying I'm a skeptic, but I am simply not able, willing, or indeed ready to therefore say that demonic possession doesn't exist. Having a faith in God rather behooves me, I think, to be willing to consider the potential of demonic possession. And I have heard some strange stories from people, including when I was at Bible college training to be a minister. And I remember we weren't actually formally trained on this subject of possession. But at the end, I think, you know, one lecturer was asked a question about, like, you know, the supernatural, and he said, oh, well, you know, you might well go to houses and don't be surprised if sometimes you might see things, objects flying around the room. And I was like, what? So, you know, these things, I don't know. I am definitely open to the supernatural, but I think the demonic possession angle is so dangerous and has so many potentials of being exploited that I just have a great caution about it. I think, like many of the other clergy I've heard about, I would be extremely careful or reluctant to label something as supernatural or demonic, particularly with the potential abuses that could happen to the individual involved. But I'm not going to shut the door and say, therefore, it never ever happens. So in short, I'm undecided about demonic possession. Now, just as an aside, I just want to say, I wrote this. Well, I'm reading some of this out, right? And so this little section I'm reading out, and I wrote this last night, and I wrote, so in short, I'm undecided about demonic possession. But now on my page, I can just see three long lines of commas. And that's because as soon as I said I'm undecided about demonic possession, my the keyboard on my MacBook, basically the key started pressing by itself a constant stream of commas on the screen. But I don't mean the key depressed itself. I couldn't see it move down. I just saw commas going on the screen. So it was just some sort of weird glitch, and the computer didn't respond, and I had to reboot after that. Not that this proves anything, of course, but the timing was kind of bizarre. And now recording this, I've just heard a weird voice. I don't know what that was. That must have been someone upstairs. Right, anyway, let's get back to bizarre. Right, let's get back to it. While I was at the conference, I interviewed a few people for their thoughts on the subject of demonic possession, and I'm going to share some of those thoughts with you now. Okay, so just a quick question, really. After the conference today, how do you feel about the subject of demonic possession? Is there anything to it, or do you feel it's something that's all in the mind, or somewhere in between? What do you think?
Kind of really mixed, really. I mean, I think there's definitely people are having experiences, but I don't necessarily think we're necessarily any further forward as to understanding exactly what causes those experiences. But I suppose what today's allowed to happen is for us to understand a kind of multidisciplinary approach, which allows us to look at it from different angles, you know, from a sort of religious belief perspective, from a mental health perspective. And I dare say, in amongst all of that, you'll find the truth. But exactly where that truth lies, I'm not necessarily convinced anyone's actually established that just yet.
Anybody else? Any thoughts?
I think my sense of it really is that all paranormal experiences, be they ghosts, UFOs, possession, anything, are more similar to each other than they are different from each other. So I think it boils down to people have experiences which to them are very genuine, that they don't understand, but actually there's some cause in the mind or externally which causes it. And it's just the context that people are in as to whether they interpret it as ghosts, UFOs.
Well, I've really enjoyed today. I don't particularly believe demonic possessions actually exist or they've occurred, but I'm very interested to get people's understanding, gain more knowledge on the subject, and just be open-minded, really.
So I'm coming at it probably from a more or less purely sceptic position, but I'm fascinated by the subject. I think it's really, really interesting. It's been a fascinating day to kind of hear psychological perspectives, but also to hear other narratives, other accounts, and also to hear from people who believe in possession as well. It's just been a really, really good mix of opinions and scholarly approaches to it, and it's been great.
Well, as a historical thing, I can see that it's something that's been written about a lot, and that, as I was explaining earlier, it's something that people could actually gain prestige out of, and that it gave people who were perhaps oppressed, such as women or minorities or children, it gave them an outlet to perhaps speak their minds.
Okay. And so does that mean for you feel it's not authentic, that there isn't actually an objective demon possessing an individual?
I'm an agnostic over that, really.
Okay.
I definitely don't believe that it's a objective discarnate entity.
Okay.
I think what they were saying earlier about it sort of being an aspect of your your own brain, your own personality. That works a lot better for me. But it does give you permission to connect with stuff that is subversive. And like you said, it gives people that don't have a voice. It can actually be empowering as well as destructive, I think.
Yeah, interesting. And you guys, any thoughts?
Well, I'm a psychologist, so of course I tend to lean towards the sort of psychological explanation.
Yes.
But even so, you know, be open-minded and always look for the evidence, which is very little, unfortunately, for exorcism. But I think from the talks today, what is interesting is there's always the argument of power relations in terms of an exorcism. Where really you've got how much in an exorcism is because someone's possessed, and how much is it because a priest is telling you you're possessed and telling you, I'll read these passages out, I'll say, be gone, demon, and you're feeling better.
Yeah.
But
There's an interesting thing with Irving Goffman, where he talks about his book Asylums. He talks about people who are sections in mental hospitals.
Yeah.
They're not going to get out until they actually accept and say, okay, I am mentally ill. And I think it's a little bit like with demonic possession as well. You sort of stick that label on it. If something is not right with me, okay, I'm possessed, we can deal with that now.
Yeah,
and
like
I can get through it, and I can get out the other side.
Someone with authority has told you you've got this particular diagnosis, and this is what you need to do to be cured.
Yeah.
And when you go through the motions of what the therapist is telling you, you then can leave.
Yeah.
How different is that to that's very similar to a priest telling you you're possessed by a demon, now it's gone.
So, we can deal with this, we'll do this and this and this, and then you're free.
If for whatever reason this evening you would witness some sort of exorcism situation in which there was irrefutable proof, perhaps, I don't know, like somebody levitating or spinning around the room, there was something that you were like, this is far beyond psychology, how would that affect your worldview, and would that be something you would find a welcome experience or a disturbing one?
Absolutely welcome, and because it's only through gathering that kind of information and evidence that we can actually progress anything effectively. So I think when we had, I think it was Susan Laybourne speaking earlier this afternoon, I found her talk really, really interesting. But as a scientist, I was very frustrated that she didn't jump on the opportunity to grab that ectoplasm, grab that shriveled plant, send it off for analysis. Yeah. When it's all there, ready and waiting, you can make some real insight. If that actually really did happen, there's so many opportunities sat right in front of you to actually really further the field. And I know for some people, it is more about their own experience and their own belief and, you know, experience in the moment, and they don't feel they need to, you know, try and challenge or justify it because it's true to them. But I think in order to be able to understand and widen and further the general understanding of a subject, you do need that empirical, peer-reviewed evidence to actually give any weight or credibility to anything. And without that, you are just left with superstition and anecdotal evidence, which actually isn't robust enough to actually get people talking about a subject or indeed challenging opinion.
Exactly. I suppose there's a deeper question then behind it. It's which worldview would you prefer? You know, if it could be proved either way, would you rather live in a world in which demonic possession is true or not?
Christ. Well, for me personally, I'm an atheist, so if somebody could prove to me that the supernatural world did actually exist, that would raise such horrors all around that you would have to take on sort of the broader lines of philosophy and religious philosophy and look at why, in a world like this, demonic possession actually exists, why a beneficent God would actually allow this sort of thing to exist. And for me, that would be, it would bring chaos into what I think is a fairly sort of neutral world. It would bring other elements into sort of my own philosophy that I really wouldn't welcome anymore.
What last question? If it was proved in that way and it would bring chaos, would it bring any sense of comfort in the possibility that if there's a bad side, then that suggests there could possibly be a good side, or would it just be chaos?
I think it would be chaos, because if you go to the logical conclusion that there is a bad side to life that allows possession by a demon, then you have to think that there's a good side to balance it, and it's not doing anything to counteract the bad side. So to me, that is chaos.
Interesting. Fascinating. Thank you very much.
I'd find it fascinating. I'd record it, for starters.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it would be
get
up on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I'm wealthy now.
I would love to see that. Bring it on.
Yeah, write a book on
as long as it isn't somebody that I love, bring it on.
I would take it as proof that there's more in this life than we know of, and it leans towards evidence of a life after death.
Yes.
And so I've always said that of all the cryptozoological creatures, a ghost is the one I most want to like to be real.
Yeah.
Because life after death. Yeah. We all want that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's absolutely true, actually, because I've often thought that I mean, if I could have one Fortean subject solved tomorrow, I'd love to know if there's aliens. I'd love to know if Bigfoot exists. But even if I found that out tomorrow, it wouldn't really affect my life or my family in the same way as if I discovered the afterlife exists. That changes everything in a sense. So I see what you mean. Thank you very much. That's really, really interesting.
You're very welcome.
And so there you have it. A rather epic journey through demonic possession movies and an exploration of the real-life implications and explanations. At the other end of it, I'm left undecided on the subject, though theoretically I'm open to it potentially happening. However, the potential for misdiagnosis and abuse of this scares me, frankly, and I've read too many cases of people, often children, accused of demonism and being effectively tortured and abused in the name of divine cleansing. I just do not think that is something God would approve of, personally. One thing I do think the devil must like to do, though, is to put barriers between people. That he likes to steal, kill, and destroy unity. The Hebrew word Satan means adversary, but the Greek translation gives the word diabolos, and the root of diabolo means to divide or separate. At the start, I said that the Exorcist movie divided people into those who flocked to it and those who condemned it. And in a sense, both sides looked at one another with fear and disdain. The people who liked horror movies, they're weird, warped Satanists. And those Christians who don't let us watch horror movies are horrible, you know, theological straitjackets. And sadly, that seems to be a common quirk of humanity, that we love to segregate ourselves and split ourselves off into groups, be that racial segregation or political segregation or religious warfare between opposing worldviews, or even in the fact that some Christians would never ever sit down and have a glass of wine with witches or occultists, as I did at this conference. Or indeed, some occultists might never want to sit down with a Christian because they might feel like they would be judged or sort of dragged away from their beliefs. For me, you know, these are just human beings. We're all just human beings on a journey to work out what the heck does it mean to be a human in this universe. And while of course we might have very different ideas of what the answers might be, I still think it makes a lot more sense to treat each other like human beings, not to demonize each other, and also to hang out with one another and sort of talk and learn and just get to know each other. On the train home from this conference, I wrote the following tweet on my Twitter feed. I wrote, "Great conference, a reminder that Christians, skeptics, and paranormalists don't need to be scared of one another." Yet the problem is, I think, we are. Which means I sometimes wonder if perhaps Satan is at his most influential, at his most possessive, if you will, when he possesses not the individual, but entire people groups, entire factions, when he turns one group against another group, often through fear, and that fear usually eventually leads to hatred. I can't help but wonder if the devil doing stuff like that will play more into his strategy and plan than possessing some individual. The worrying thing is just because demonic possession might be incredibly rare doesn't mean that demonic activity is uncommon. Who knows how much evil may influence us and divide us every day? But perhaps that's a subject for another podcast. So in a word, demonic possession to me means a lot of interesting and cool movies, but in the real world, extreme caution required. Well, that's it for another episode of The Flicks the Church Forgot. I hope you found it all interesting. Do follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws and join me at the Facebook page at The Flicks the Church Forgot, or indeed email me at contactus@theflicksthechurchforgot.com. But until next time, don't get possessed, and also don't forget The Flicks the Church Forgot.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I ask for your attention? Just for a minute. Soon you'll be caught up in the events taking place on the screen. And then you may forget all about me. Well, almost, anyway. You see, I must confess to a certain feeling of propriety towards the story that's about to begin, because, immodest though it may sound, I play an extremely important part in the proceedings. In fact, without me, there really wouldn't be any story at all. Of course, you won't actually see me. Unfortunately, in recent centuries, that has gone out of fashion. Although there was a time when I was always being painted or impersonated in one way or another. And as you know, I've always been given the best lines. However, like all of us, I've had to learn to adapt to what is absurdly called a rational age. And I've done so by, by going underground. And no doubt some of you, the rationalists, the skeptics, will say, like the little girl in this picture, that what you can't see can't exist. Well, my friends, you go on thinking that as long as you can. Because sooner or later, one way or another, you'll discover your mistake. Anyway, now I'll leave you alone in the dark and let my little story take over. Enjoy yourselves, but don't forget that that stranger sitting in the seat next to you could be me. Yes,